that Mary was going around with an old flame. That burned me up, because I knew he was just beating her a line. But the guy really spent his money like water. I think he was connected, so I left. Outside, it was raining cats and dogs. I was feeling mighty blue, and everything looked black. But I carried on.
CT 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cacciato, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, good morning, everybody. It's actually, you know, is it morning? Now it's afternoon. It's officially 12 o'clock here. Welcome. You know, we're in here chatting today with somebody. But before I introduce them, I do want to say that any views expressed today by myself or by my guest are strictly our own and not necessarily those of WRCT. But I'd like to welcome today to our show a good friend of mine, our resident Kiwi here at CMU. This is Grady Kennix. Good morning, Grady.
Good morning, Anthony. How you doing?
There we go. We got you now.
Good morning, Anthony. How you doing?
Oh, I'm fantastic. We have an interesting topic today. For those of you who haven't been keeping up with the news, because it's dreadful to open up a newspaper or open up social media, because it keeps on getting worse. You know, there was recently a development in which the cost associated with an H-1B visa, which for those of you unfamiliar, the H-1B visa is one of the visas offered to people seeking to immigrate to the United States for high-skilled workers, are people of exceptional talent who come to the United States, are Elon Musks of the world. And the cost associated with that went from $1,000 to $100,000. And this has provoked some responses from people on the left and the right. This will be an interesting conversation because technically we're both on the right. We have some starkly different views on this kind of development here. But, you know, kind of per you know, my courtesy I extend to any guest on the show, I'd like to invite you to kind of, you know, share your reflections first on this, Grady, and kind of tell me what do you think about this?
Oh, me personally? Absolutely. Well, look, I'd have to push back a little bit against the characterization of H-1B as the visa for America's top talent. That's the O-1, and it's, or the very best and brightest, that's your Einstein visa, you know? The H-1B visa was initialized as a kind of, you know, slightly lower talent visa. And that it did that job for a very long time. It brought in people like Elon Musk, Melania Trump, just really great people, you know? Came here on H-1B visas. But in recent years, in recent decades, I'd say, fraud has become endemic in the H-1B visa, and the sheer numbers have both risen and skewed towards a very different base of countries than we were previously accustomed to seeing. And as a result, H-1Bs have become less of a tool for getting the best and brightest future taxpayers into America and more of a tool for getting cheap labor. to be as blunt as I possibly can.
Well, I'd like to kind of, you know, hear more from you, because you say kind of like the countries we're looking for or cheap labor. You know, I'm curious, you know, because there is still, you know, a requirement based on skill. You know, sure, we're not talking about necessarily our Einsteins. You kind of mentioned that there's this kind of slightly lower threshold of talent, but you know, this, we're still talking about skilled labor here. I mean, you know, these are the people that, you know, come to our universities, become engineers or computer scientists, and ultimately, you know, seek in many ways to bring those talents to the American labor force and help provide the skilled labor that drives some of these industries that we're looking to excel in right now, is particularly AI. And I think you see that footprint, especially here in Pittsburgh and at Carnegie Mellon, where we have a good number of international students that are, you know, seeking to stay here after they complete their studies and will in many ways help us kind of keep the edge in these fields. But I mean, you know, talk to me a little bit more about your kind of thoughts on, you know, what this fraud is, how it's, you know, in your mind, abused.
Oh, absolutely. Don't get me wrong. The people at Carnegie Mellon are the best and the brightest, by any definition of best or brightest. But what's really troubling about the H-1B visa is how this idea of, like, talent and measuring talent can be so quickly abused. We've seen, for example, to give just one example, there's a whole list of criteria you can use to prove your talent, you know? And one of them is judging a hackathon. We all know and love hackathons. We've got some great ones at CMU. And so fraudulent hackathons have sprung up where you don't pay to enter, you pay to judge. And people will submit, like, ChatGPT, slop, and, well, the judges judge it, and then they put, "We judged a hackathon," on their, you know, their application, and they send it through. And this is just one of many, many, many ways that these things can be gamed. I'm talking fake diplomas. I'm talking diplomas from online universities, or universities that give you 1 week's worth of coursework for a hefty fee in India or China or wherever you are. And then you put that on your application, and look at that. Now you're going for an H-1B, and you have a serious chance of getting it. That's the kind of fraud I'm talking about, and surveys of H-1B applications have shown that just right off the bat, between, I think it was 30 and 40% are just provable fraud, and that's just the ones they could catch immediately from randomly selected samples of H-1B visas. That seems like a problem to me. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, so, you know, kind of, sure, I mean, we could look at, you know, there are reported issues with the program, but it seems like the response has been, instead of saying, you know, we're going to have some more robust ways of checking the validity of some of these things. Because quite frankly, you know, you could even look at, say, something that isn't, you know, a government program, like college admissions generally. The amount of gaming the system that happens in applying for college is immense. We'll put it that way. And, you know, I think, you know, great. You know, we want to make sure that our systems are working the way that they're supposed to. But it seems like kind of this knee-jerk reaction to increase the cost threshold of an H-1B visa has not been to kind of deal with those sort of issues, but rather say, you know, like, we want to make it monetarily more difficult for people to pursue this program. I mean, you know, very often you have people that come from countries where the GDP per capita is abysmal. You know, these people are, quite frankly, coming from countries that are, they're dead ends where their talent would otherwise be completely wasted. You know, very often people will say, you know, like, we have Einsteins all over the world, but some of them are in places where they're either going to, you know, die at the age of 30, or they're, you know, like, they're basically stuck in this dead end situation. And, you know, that's why the H-1B visa program allows us to not only give them an opportunity, but they give back the opportunity to us to help us nationally excel. You know, and I think this is, you know, why it's so important to look at, you know, in the context of the AI race. You know, so many people, you know, especially in the admin, are saying, we want to be at the forefront of AI development right now. We want to be basically running circles around China, especially. And that's why we had an AI and energy summit here at Carnegie Mellon, where Senator McCormick brought all of these stakeholders together, including the president. But, you know, instrumental in this process is making sure that we have the best and the brightest here. And that means in all of the above approach, which means, you know, sure, we are cultivating our talent at home, but why would we turn away talent that seeks to come to our country and make our country better? And ultimately, and you know, this is something that I kind of had the opportunity to write about for some of my coursework, the idea that, you know, when you have this influx of highly skilled labor, they have high disposable income, and that creates jobs in of itself. And, you know, in our unskilled sector, especially providing, you know, entry level jobs for native, you know, people that are born in the United States as well. There, you know, it's kind of, I think the problem that's kind of endemic in this kind of debate is the idea that this is all zero sum, when, you know, the zero sum model of the economy is something that's often parroted by people on the left that see capitalism to be this kind of cutthroat, like war, where, you know, whereas, you know, there's $1 trillion bills, if they existed. Well, actually, no, they do exist because the Fed has printed them sometimes to justify their kind of ludicrous spending. But we're not getting there. That's a conversation for another day. But there's literally, there's $1 trillion bills laying on the sidewalk. And we have to kind of have the kind of knowledge and ability as a country to say, like, hey, we have these opportunities to make, to, you know, have the tide that lifts all boats here. But I've kind of, you know, waded into this water a little bit. Feel free to kind of address any of that that you see to be most important.
Oh, no, you're totally right. I mean, this, like, zero-sum thinking is pervasive on the right, and I do think it's wrong. I also think that, like, well, for example, I'm a mathematician, and in math there are these, like, people back in, like, the 50s, 60s that were called the Hungarian aliens or the Martians, and they were the most talented mathematicians in the world, and we brought them all over from Hungary on O-1 visas, I believe it was, maybe even some H-1 visas in there, and they revolutionized American mathematics. So, yeah, there's definitely a case to make for top talent. Nobody's saying that there's not talent all around the world. But, well,
there's always a but.
Yes, there's always a but. But what does matter, what does really matter here, is that we take the best and the most qualified in America first, if we break ties by that matter. Or even worse, if there's someone more qualified in America for a job posting, we should not be taking someone from overseas, right? That seems pretty straightforward. That's an efficient market right there. That's a decent thing to do. And one thing that I worry about is that that's not always the case here. You see these things like perm job ads. I don't know. Are you familiar with perm advertising?
Perm advertising. Explain for me and the casual listener here.
Absolutely. All right. So companies are under some very strict restrictions when they want to hire a foreign national. And one of the restrictions is that they have to make a good faith effort to select an American worker first. And this, in practice, boils down to posting an advertisement called a perm ad in newspapers, on the internet, whatever. And this, for decades and decades, back in the Elon Musk era of H-1B immigration, this worked very well. But as time has gone on and shadier actors have moved into this business, because it is riddled with shady actors, people who will, you know, who are basically coyotes just for a different population, who are promising to get you in if you pay a certain fee. Brief distraction in the studio there. These shady actors will do anything to hire a foreign national because they can pay them cheaper. And so what happens is you see perm ads posted now in tremendous numbers in, like, back catalogs of magazines nobody reads, on websites whose web address is a billion-digit long string, or they have a requirement you have to be familiar with version 14.0.1 of this internal company software, which we will then offer to our chosen applicant. Like, the ways that the system is gamed are immense, and every one of these gamings of the system takes away from the efficiency of this labor market. It prevents us from hiring the best and the most qualified American worker. Although, I do think you're completely right about the $100,000 fee. Like, that seems like a very blunt instrument to use. I would caution that they're the executive branch. The Congress stipulates all of these things, and they only have certain levers to pull, and one of those is this fee. They can jack it up, but I'm really hoping that in the future we see an actual overhaul of the H-1B system, one that expands the O-1 visa for top talent, one that becomes better at detecting fraudulent applications and attempts to prove skill that isn't actually there. One that's better at getting perm ads posted and such, and other ways for American applicants to get their foot in the door. One that's better about getting those American applicants a fair chance and a fair go. These things are important, and I would like to see an actual overhaul of that through Congress, but in the short term, this is one of the only levers the executive can pull.
Yeah, so I wanted to touch briefly on something you mentioned before, where you were talking about, you know, like, the strategy right now is to kind of bypass the permit process in order to get applicants who otherwise, you know, they could hire for cheaper. And, you know, I think that's, you know, and you say that there's kind of an issue with the efficiency in the system here, but, you know, I think the kind of PERMAD requirement in some ways is an example of a regulatory inefficiency, you know, in the sense that, you know, sure, you want it to be meritocratic, but, you know, when anyone is deciding, you know, if they're going to hire or, you know, they're going to buy something, because labor is a commodity, and you know, that's we can't pretend otherwise we're treading into Karl Marx territory, you know, all this to say that, you know, when you're making consideration about whether or not you're going to spend your money on someone or something in the market, you're going to consider, you know, efficiency, quality as compared to cost. And I think that's a totally fair thing to do, because, you know, when you're talking about AI, for example, you know, let's say you're Sam Altman, and, you know, for OpenAI, you're thinking about how you want to hire your workers. You know, especially when you're dealing with, you know, the issue of, you know, how much money are you making, because this is a venture capital operation, and very often these companies are, you know, running some interesting financial situations, and, you know, we can talk another time on the show about whether or not there's a bubble that's, you know, on the verge of bursting. But needless to say, you know, cost considerations, including overhead, are important. And, you know, sure, you want to hire the best engineers for your AI. Because if you're Sam Altman, you're competing with Google, you're competing with Meta, you have, you know, a lot to consider. And, you know, whether or not you are hiring the best and brightest is among, if not the top considerations. But it's important to also consider, you know, how much do I have to pay on a per engineer or per programmer basis? That's important. And I think that, you know, generally this desire to hire people who are going to kind of, the return on investment is going to be higher for these workers. If they're foreign workers that come on H-1B visas, that's kind of the whole point. You know, we have the ability to bring the people who are going to have the highest ROI. That is essential for providing this service, which now increases productivity in all number of sectors in the economy, makes us all productive as a result, and basically it grows the pie for everybody. There's you know, this kind of deals with, you know, when we're looking at especially kind of like the arguments around, you know, tariffs and protectionism, talking about domestic industry versus, you know, trade with foreign industry, considering, you know, like, you know, do we have this kind of necessary obligation to protect domestic industries or to hire domestic workers, even if there is a kind of lack of efficiency? Because sure, you might lose 20,000 jobs in, you know, like, well, we'll use over here, for example, you might lose 20,000 jobs in steelmaking, but, you know, the cost of creating steel or other durable goods that are necessary for the production of houses, for example, creates this massive diffuse benefit in which houses are cheaper to build, or, you know, apartment complexes are cheaper to build, and then, you know, that factors into rent prices later on. You know, it's the kind of ongoing conversation in kind of numerous circles about diffuse benefits versus concentrated losses. So I think it's also interesting, before we kind of get into more of this, I think a good interesting point of context for the audience here. So Grady, if you can't tell, has an accent. Grady's from New Zealand. Grady came to the United States. How recently is this now?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. I was born in the United States. My family came here as late as the 1960s. So immigrating to the United States is a very recent memory. But there's this interesting dynamic, I think, is, you know, worth pointing out, that you have the the guy, you know, who's lived his whole life in the United States saying, you know, maybe we should bring in foreign talent. And the guy who came here 2 years ago is like, you know what? Maybe there's some problems with that. Not to say that, you know, like, you know, you have no ground to stand on. I just think it's a really funny contrast.
It is an interesting contrast, yes. It kind of surprises me sometimes. what I would say is two things. One, I like that you brought up Karl Marx, because I think he had some insights to share.
Interesting. The plot continues to thicken.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of his insights was this idea of the reserve army of labor, which is just that when you have more workers, that does not actually necessarily benefit workers' bargaining power. Because what it does, especially when they're divided and not in, like, a giant union, because what will happen then is that bosses or employers will be able to just say, okay, look, we're going to take these other guys and we're going to pay them less. And if you want to protest against this, but the fact that we're lowering your wages as well, well, then we'll fire you and take more of these other guys. That's the central concept of it. And the thing about that is that, well, I mean, it has orthodox capitalist explanations too. You know, you could say, okay, the supply of labor is going up, the price is going down, however you want to say it. This is trouble for that domestic labor supply. It spells trouble. And I think they're fully within their rights as freely associating people in a country that they run, you know, that they have some kind of natural right to that I don't think capitalism quite expresses, quite captures.
I'm interested because you invoked natural rights. Do you have a right to, let's say, this will be a fun one. Do you have a right to a living wage?
No, not really.
Do you have a right to first priority over higher wages?
I don't think so, no.
So I'm curious where kind of this, you're deriving this kind of like, you know, you have a right as a kind of resident of this nation who's kind of was born here and lives here, a kind of first dibs right on these wages, and, you know, kind of not the debasing of wages through market forces when new people enter the labor force, if I'm understanding your argument correctly.
Well, at that point, Anthony, it's not even really about the wages anymore. It's just about the natural right of free people to say who comes into their country and who doesn't. I believe they do have that right, and it's not really a right given by God or anything. It's a right enshrined in force. They live in the country. They can choose if a person wants to walk into that country or not.
So I'm curious, because we're entering, like, the territory of, like, does this fall... Listen, I'm a libertarian, and I don't pretend to be otherwise. You know, I have a very defined scope of what a right is, and I think you're invoking this kind of idea of, like, a positive right, sort of, like, the force provided by government to exclude certain people from its borders. This is kind of like a nebulous right that I'm not sure exactly where it comes from.
I shouldn't phrase it as a right. You're completely right. It's just a thing. It's a de jure fact. A de jure and de facto, because at this point the law is the fact. It's just a thing, a fact of life. The government sits within the borders and it has the military and it has the immigration control. And if immigrants want to cross its borders, it's not that it has the right to exclude them. It's just that it can, you know?
Well, I think then you get into the question of, should it? You know, listen, I there's a couple things. Before briefly I kind of respond to what you just said, I do want to, you know, think it's important to note that, you know, this idea that, you know, when labor prices or wages go down, that isn't always necessarily a terrible thing. You know, this kind of goes back to the diffuse benefits and concentrated losses. You know, in a particular sector, there might be concentrated losses wherein, you know, like, the kind of average wage will fall. But, you know, what does this allow a company to do? If they're able to hire more workers, there's more productivity on the part of that firm, which in turn allows supply to increase and, you know, relative demand. That makes general prices fall. There's the diffuse benefit in the market of the fact that these people that are consumers of whatever service or good is being produced by the firm that now has lower, like, per capita wages, you have this kind of diffuse benefit. It's like, great, things are cheaper now. That's awesome. You know, like, I now have more disposable income as an individual because things have gotten marginally cheaper. And that's, you know, you can't write that off. But, you know, I kind of want to fall back on something you said here, you know, kind of think, you know, goes to, like, how do we discuss immigration generally here in the United States. And, you know, personally, my view is, you know, I think, yes, it's important. You know, we have borders. You have to enforce that. But I've always kind of had this view of, you know, we want to have a tall fence with big, beautiful gates. Big, beautiful gates. No, it's, but quite, you know, literally, you know, this idea that, you know, yes, you should enforce your border, but it's important that we have a robustly simplified immigration system, because right now you have to jump through like 30 hoops to get to here. And especially this is a problem for people who come here, you know, seeking opportunity to display the kind of grander ability of their skills. These people that come here to engage in skilled labor, our H-1B, our O-1 visa recipients that come here and contribute so much. And this isn't even to say that just regular unskilled labor coming from, you know, immigration is a bad thing too, because that, you know, it's a rising tide that lifts all boats, that, you know, sure has concentrated losses but diffuse benefits. And, you know, this is also kind of the argument for free trade. When goods and, you know, labor is in itself a good, when these things can permeate borders with greater ease, there's a diffuse economic benefit to everybody. And that's not something to be written off, I don't think.
You're totally right. But what really matters here, I think you'd agree, is like the ratio of that, you know, diffuse benefit to that concentrated loss. If there was a concentrated loss to 99% of the society somehow, as if that's concentrated, then it wouldn't really be concentrated anymore, would it, you know? And one thing you see in polling today is that majorities, or in some polls, very close minorities, of Americans support, and this is Americans, not Trump voters, Americans, support what Trump's doing on immigration. That suggests to me that these losses are not as concentrated as we would like them to be. They seem to have affected wide swaths of America's manufacturing classes, America's textiles and farming and construction classes, and that is, I think, something to worry about. And the other thing that I'd really be worrying about here is, well, in economics you have, I'm not an econ student.
You do math. Which,
I do math.
My particular strain of economists aren't very happy with math sometimes, but we'll set that aside. I trust you on the math front.
You know. All right. Well, this is unfortunately a non-math concept. It's just a vibes-based one, but it's the idea of, in fact, something purely unmathematical, an uncaptured externality. And the thing I'd worry here, like for example, for viewers who don't know what that is, it's, for example, when a corporation pumps out some toxic waste into a surrounding neighborhood. That is an externality of their production process that does not necessarily immediately affect their bottom line. And you can make very good arguments, that it does eventually affect their bottom line, people stop buying from them and so forth. But what I'd worry about here is the uncaptured externality of, well, like H-1B immigration. The externality here, to be very explicit, is, how do I put this? Like, you bring in a guy, all right? And, oh, wait a minute, I'm tripping over my tongue here. You bring in a guy, and, like, the corporation that is employing him for a lower wage, they're benefiting from that, but they're not at all, like, oh, sorry, that was it. Sorry, I'm going cuckoo. The H-1B visa has very many provisions for bringing over dependents and for bringing over family and for essentially setting up root as an immigrant in the United States of America. Which is great. We love to see that when it's done right. But the trouble is that the externality of educating dependents, raising dependents, allowing these dependents to go to public school, for example, which the Supreme Court has said again and again is very constitutional, that isn't an externality imposed solely on the state and on the welfare system and not at all on the corporation employing them. And that's something that I would worry about a little bit. There are other externalities that are less quantifiable than just that straight-up tax burden of raising dependents, but are nonetheless important, like loss of national language and culture. These are things we have to worry about, and I don't think they're adequately captured by current immigration policy. And the thing is, people tend to agree. Again, wide swaths of America support what I'm saying here, that this immigration has gone too far and we're losing some of these intangibles. And I'd like to, you know, how would you respond to
that? Yeah, so there's a couple things I'll say. I want to quickly address the thing I agree with and then talk about some of the things I kind of have some issues with. But firstly, I think, you know, I agree that, you know, there's kind of considerations around, you know, people who immigrate to this country aren't all U.S. citizens, whether or not they're entitled to education in public schools, whether or not they're entitled to benefit of the welfare state if they're not paying in, things like that. I think that, quite frankly, if the case is brought, a case is brought to the Supreme Court, that they will overturn that precedent. I think that that does not stick. And I think that, you know, I agree with you on that front. I mean, that kind of deals more so with my opinions on the welfare state, but that's another story for another time. You know, in the last minute 30 that we have, I just kind of want to briefly say, one of the biggest problems I've had in kind of talking about this issue is, you know, you kind of talk a little bit about, like, loss of national culture, like national language. I really don't think that either of those things have tangible kind of concrete existence outside of, you know, like, I don't think we have a national language. I think, you know, that's never been established in the United States, neither should it. You know, but also the fact that, you know, we as a country exist not as a country of a certain ethnicity or race. We exist as a country which is based on a certain set of ideals that we commonly share, and that's what sets us apart from every other country in the world. We are, you know, not, and this kind of encapsulated in a Reagan quote in his final speech as president. You know, like, you can go to France, but you'll never be a Frenchman. You can go to Japan, but you'll never be Japanese. Anyone from any quarter of the United States can come to the United States and be an American. We have like 30 seconds left, so I'm going to use this time to, you know, thank you, Grady, for coming on today. This has been a robust conversation, and I definitely want to continue it sometime, both on and off the air, but thank you very much, Grady.
Thank you for having me, Anthony.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today for this episode. Hope you all have a wonderful rest of your day. Take care, and God bless.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, this is Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and today I have Dean Shinas here to talk about freedom of speech on campus. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So free speech is a very broad topic you can probably talk about all day and all night. But specifically, I'm bringing you here because you've got a lot of expertise in dealing with it when it comes to college campuses. So what do you think makes the situation unique when it comes to this specific context?
Well, first let me say this is not my topic. My expertise is a faculty member. But interestingly, I've had to become knowledgeable about it because of being a dean and all the things that have come up since I'm a dean for 10 years. So, you know, the big topic is that in order to actually do research and educate students and have people learn, there has to be a freedom of expression so people can test out ideas, they can say things that other people might find offensive, et cetera, et cetera. And so for us to actually function in the way we need to as a university, we have to maintain a healthy respect for and support for freedom of expression on campus.
Can you start us off by giving us an example of a context where you've had to deal with threading that needle between being respectful, being a learning environment, and also letting people speak?
Sure. We've had a bunch of different really interesting events. But when I was early on in my deanship, one of my English professors came to me and said, can we do a year of events commemorating Karl Marx's 200th birthday? And I was like, sure. And we did that set of events, and then somebody did an article in the Trib that was critical of us covering Karl Marx and was picked up by some national media, and the trustees were unhappy, called our president, called our provost, called me, et cetera. And the president was very supportive in saying, look, this is academic freedom. We need to cover this. But it was extremely difficult to convince everybody that this is a crucial thing we have to maintain as a university if we're going to actually, even when they were very much against Marxism, the idea of Marxism, and took it to be a threat to the world in general.
So I feel like that also brings into play academic freedom, which is somewhat of a different thing than freedom of speech. How would you say the two interact?
Well, in freedom of speech, which is from our Constitution, this is a legal matter, and they've made lots of different decisions in the Supreme Court supporting it. And over time, it's become more and more clear that they're going to be extremely unrestrictive of freedom of speech. Hate speech is protected speech, weirdly enough, legally. And the reason is because you can't identify a set of words as hate speech without the context, making it really, really clear what's hate and what's not. And the example I'll give is all lives matter. Nobody would think those three words by themselves are really hateful speech. But in the context of when George Floyd was murdered and the fence was painted Black Lives Matter, and then someone came and crossed out black and put all lives matter became, I think, in many people's minds, an example of hate speech. And so I think that everybody in the legal system agrees that unless we can find a very, very clear definition of hate speech that we could apply in every context, then it's much, much better to not regulate it. On the academic side of the coin, in the academy, when research and education is the mission, there was, like many other institutions, no such thing as freedom of speech, because if you're in a company and you say something the company doesn't like, you can be fired, even though the Constitution protects your right to say it. It doesn't protect you from saying it for that company. So the academy had to actually add protections so that when you were working in the academy as a professor or a student, you had protections that were at least more than you could actually ask in a company you worked for. And this all started in the very early 20th century when professors were routinely fired for their political views, their views that were critical of the campuses they worked on, etc. And the American Association for University Professors came up with not a union, but an organization that tried to encode what do we mean by academic freedom and what does it actually allow us to do. And so from about 1915 until now, there's been a very, very powerful movement to try to make sure the academy protects freedom of speech and freedom of research and freedom of expression much, much more robustly than companies do, for example. Now, public universities are required to follow the constitutional protection, but private universities like Carnegie Mellon are not. We choose to.
So specifically, you were talking about Karl Marx, and that was Kathy Newman, who we have had on the show about banned books. But what would you say makes a university follow free speech? Because, I mean, Dr. Newman made the point that the Constitution is very vague. It's Congress shall make no law.
Right. Well, I would say the legal system and the way it's been the way the Constitution has been interpreted by the legal system is robustly protective of free speech. That's not to say that you can say anything you want. You can't make threats. Right? You can't harass. You can't actually do child pornography. You can't do obscenity in public. There's many, many ways your speech is restricted. And in particular, time and manner. So if you want to say something politically, you can't go into someone's neighborhood and just shout it with a megaphone at 2 a.m. when people are expecting to be sleeping. Right. So there's lots of ways in which there's restrictions. But I think in the academy, when we're trying to have an environment in which people can explore potentially controversial ideas, transgender rights, abortion, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, et cetera, et cetera. We need an environment in which people can explore different perspectives, different opinions, different, ways of thinking about this thing freely so they can hear counterarguments and so they can learn. And so the other topic I wanted to make sure I get to is the difference between the kind of restrictions or non-restrictions we get from the law and from policies on campus and the kind of restrictions on speech from social norms, right? So many students will tell me that, if they're on social media or they're in a group of friends, there's things they don't say because they're afraid of being shamed or they're afraid that what they'll say is looking at weird, it's not the in-group's opinion, et cetera, et cetera. So in my view, that's a much more powerful influence on restricting and chilling your speech than any policy I as a dean will put forth or we as a university will put forth. Would you agree?
I think it depends, because there's definitely ways that universities can fully shut down speech. But also, I do agree that social norms are a very powerful motivator.
I mean, we found just by looking at some data, asking some surveys and questions, that the students feel very uncomfortable sharing controversial opinions, especially if they're conservative opinions, with their peers on campus, not just in class. And so I think for sure there's a pretty large social pressure that many students feel.
Yeah. So I feel like that also doesn't just apply to students, because I know professors and academics also have a bit of an issue with viewpoint diversity.
Absolutely. So if you're a professor in a class, right? There's so many ways you can step on a landmine and do something that's stupid, right? And in many of these situations, you're not trained, right? You're trained in your subject. You're not trained on how to manage class so that there's an appropriately respectful environment for a wide array of viewpoints. Nor are you trained to figure out how to run a class so that if there's a very small representation of a certain minority, you don't treat them, right, in a disrespectful or harmful way. You know, I've seen at least a dozen incidents where professors were not just accused, but, you know, put into a situation where something they did in class was questioned. And then their reaction to it was to say, I'm not going to do any of this ever again. I'm just going to talk about my subject down the road and then leave. You know, so that's a really unfortunate chilling of what professors need to do as well.
Yeah. And also, I think a thing about professors is that most of them by far are more on the liberal spectrum. So that's also a thing where you only get one perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that. And it's very, very difficult for professors to understand where the line is between challenging something they think is factually inaccurate, that a person on the other side of the spectrum might say, or something that they just take to be sort of a misguided political perspective. And I think that I should also mention that academic freedom, as it's been understood, right, does not give professors, right, carte blanche to just weigh in on subjects that they don't really know. So if you're a physics professor and you just stop class in the middle of talking about neutrinos and say, I want to rant against Kamala Harris or rant against Donald Trump, that is not protected by academic freedom.
No. Well, if it's not your area of expertise, it's kind of a captive audience issue.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you have to be respectful of the fact that, you know, you might feel passionately about a subject and you might believe that you're opening the class up to discuss it in a very equal way. But there's a clear power imbalance, and the students have to know, or have to at least feel, that they're at risk of, if they say something that you find politically very, very untasteful, that their grade might be at risk as well. And I can't blame the students for feeling that. That makes perfect sense to me.
With, you know, the issue of students feeling afraid to challenge their professors or afraid to challenge the social norms of their friend groups, does CMU have any initiatives to try and counteract that?
Yes, we have several, and you were a part of one. So in the Dietrich College, we have a seminar program for first-year students called the Grand Challenge Seminar Program. We take topics that are challenging to the world: racism, climate change, food security, academic and freedom of expression. And we try to cover them from a multitude of disciplines. In the course of the Grand Challenge Seminar on Academic Freedom that I taught and that you were a student in, which was a great experience for me, we spent a lot of time in the beginning trying to get the environment of the class to be bought into the idea of respect. So we were very, very passionate about telling everybody that no matter what people say, no matter how offensive it might seem to you, we must be respectful and welcoming of all viewpoints, all perspectives. And it took a few weeks, but the students, I think, were incredibly good about buying into that and actually exhibiting that behavior. And then when October 7th happened and the attack on Israel from Hamas happened, we turned the syllabus around and we said, let's discuss this. The fence was posting messages that were very, very provocative and offensive to one group or the other. And then in the class, I think the students took what we had tried to set up and really used it and were incredibly civil and very constructive. And I think we learned a lot. I mean, I learned a lot about the intent, right, of Palestinian Alliance students when the messages came out that Jewish students might find offensive, and what the Jewish students were hearing, and vice versa. And so it felt like real learning was taking place in a classroom. So I think initiatives, what we want to do is make sure that as faculty, we can teach classes in which we do the kind of civil discourse. We model it, we teach it, we encourage it, and we can see progress happen when students actually get something big out of that. And as administrators, we can try to create events and try to create other things that go on the campus, like the Deeper Conversations series we had, in which we're willing to take on these controversial issues as opposed to just being silent about them. We're willing to have discussions, and the conditions are that the discussions have to be civil. I feel like this is an issue we've just started to take on, but this is like one of the big issues that the academy or the institutions of higher education in the U.S., they need to lean into. If we can't take this on and get faculty and students to have civil discussions, no matter how polarized they might start, who's going to do it?
I feel like freedom of speech is especially a big thing on CMU's campus right now because there are new restrictions in terms of assembly and protest. So a lot of students have been protesting that and kind of are really upset about it. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, that's unfortunate because I mean, I know from my side of the fence on the administration that was not the intent at all. So what's basically happened is when protests happen or when student expression on campus happens, with or without outside people, the university feels very responsible to make sure that's safe. And what we have experienced from last year is that some of the events get very passionate and some of the people who are coming in from the outside or even coming in from the students are passionate enough that where they're trying to provoke something that I wouldn't say is just violence, but provoke something that will break out into potential violence. The campus police tell us that if they have notice there's going to be some event, right, that's going to be sizable, then they're going to be much, much more able to protect the safety of the people involved in that event, from people who came and were on counter-protest to whomever. And so the idea of the policy for 25 people to register was simply to give us a better ability to keep these events safe. And that we have a complete commitment to the content of the protest has nothing to do with it. So if you're a group that's liberal and you register versus you're a group that's conservative register, we don't care. The only thing motivating that is so we are better able to provide the security that we need to keep these things physically safe.
So as a reminder, this is Forbes Avenue. I'm Riota Duncan talking with Dean Shinas about free speech. So on that topic of the administration's view, you were part of the Commission on Academic Freedom and Free Speech. Can you tell me a little what it's like about being in that kind of room?
Yeah, that was fascinating. So the commission learned an awful lot about, what are best practices, what's the history of this thing. We got some great speakers to come in, Keith Whittington from Princeton, Erwin Chersminsky from Berkeley, other people too. And what I think we learned was that even though it's in many cases desirable to prevent people from doing events, having speech that is potentially offensive or hateful, that anything you might do to try to restrict that is probably worse in the long run than supporting the freedom of the students to hear all different kinds of perspectives, even if some people find some of them very offensive. Now, I say that, but in the room, in that committee, there were very clearly two sort of groups that evolved. And one group I would describe as more concerned with protecting, right, the environment from hateful, right, hateful speech or hateful groups or things like that. And another of the group, or the other side of the group, was more on my side, which is more supportive of free speech. I think both of us are passionately committed to the fact that we do not want a culture that's hateful or having things like that happen. But I think the approach that distinguishes us is, on my side of the fence, instead of doing it legally and with policies, let's try to do it culturally. Let's try to get the students, right, and the faculty and the staff, if there's someone coming in who's hateful, to push back on them. And so we need to protect the speech of the people pushing back on the haters as much as we need to protect the speech of the people who are potentially hateful. But on the other side of the fence, I think there are people who say that's not going to be good enough. There's still going to be people who are coming in and being anti-Semitic or, very hostile to abortion rights or transgender rights or other things that are controversial. And that letting those people come to campus and speak, right, is creating an environment that's simply unsafe or unconducive to learning. So it was a tricky issue to try to figure out where we actually came down on. And so I think in the end we agreed that we'll modify our policy a touch, but that we were going to be robustly protective of freedom of expression in general. In the long run, we think that's a better strategy.
I forget who said this, but someone said that the best response to hate speech is more speech.
I agree with that. I mean, here's the thing. You might think that I'm a okay person, and I'm okay, well, maybe not, but you might think I'm okay. So if I have to make the judgment on whether something's hate speech, you might trust me to do that reasonably. But we know from history that if the deans and the provost and the president have the ability to shut down speech because they deem it hateful, then someone down the line is going to abuse that power. And then the people end up suffering the most from that ability of administrators to shut down speech are the people who need it the most. And so to sacrifice that people or those people in the future, right, for, you know, in the present, giving us more power to sort of push back against what might be considered offensive and hateful, not to everybody, but to some, seems to me a bad trade-off. And I think that we have to be willing to be uncomfortable in many contexts in order to protect it, so that down the road, some administrator who's not well-intentioned is not able to shut down students who have a really good point to make or shut down protesters who have a good point to make. We have to hear it.
I was wondering what you thought of accountability mechanisms for free speech on campus or academic freedom, because for private universities like us, it's not that we're bound by Congress.
And I think we have to be clear in our policies to make that a value that we're actually putting out there as core value of the institution. So I think we did a great job on the Karl Marx thing. I think we did a great job on the Rick Grenell, Ambassador Grenell coming to campus. It was huge controversy over that. Many, many people wanted us to disallow it or fire him. We didn't. And I think there was a similar thing over Uju Anya and her critique of the Queen, right, which was also, I think, highly controversial. But we stood up and we protected her ability to say that and Rick Grenell's ability to say that and et cetera, et cetera. So I think the policy has to be clear, and we have to actually walk the walk, not just talk the talk. We have to make it visible to people the positive side of it, right? And we have to make sure that people can have experiences in classes or in deeper conversations or in other places where they come out of it, right? They come through being offended. They come through being uncomfortable and learn something. So I just think we have to find ways to make it vivid and visible to our students and to our faculty, that even though it might be uncomfortable, the positives are great.
So in terms of making it visible, how would you say Carnegie Mellon's been trying to do that?
Well, the two examples I gave, I'll go back to. One is the classes, and there's another class I'll point to called Dangerous Ideas, right, which Simon Cohen put forth, which explicitly took on the idea of very, very controversial topics and tried to get people to talk about them in productive ways, factually and otherwise. Danny Oppenheimer teaches a class called Human Stupidity and Human Intelligence, Thinking Online versus Thinking in Person. And in both cases, he takes on very controversial issues and tries to get the students to learn how to debate these issues, right, in ways that in the end will be much more helpful to them than just shutting each other down. And then the president and the deans, especially the dean of Hines and the dean of Dietrich, me, have made a pretty big commitment to these deeper conversations, where we try to get the issues that are controversial of the day, the Israel-Hamas, Israel-Palestinian conflict, and now the election, the polarization that's a part of it, and lean in, get it out there, and try to create venues and events and forums in which people really can discuss these things and hear perspectives that are sufficiently diverse that they can learn. And I think in the deeper conversations last year, we were very nervous about it, but we had these discussion groups on this book called Contested Histories. We had about 10 people run discussion groups, and students, faculty, and staff were all invited to come in, and each one of them filled up. And by all reports, most of those conversations went very well. There were a couple of difficult issues that came up, as one would expect. But I think what came out of it was that we need to keep doing these things. So we're not afraid to talk about controversial topics. We invite the students to come talk about it. We get readings that actually matter. We get people to come lecture who are serious, who are not just provocateurs, right? These are all hard issues, or they wouldn't be controversial. So, I mean, I just think that we have not only a duty, but we've also seen that if we do it and we do it well, it works. And that's, to me, very exciting.
In terms of discussing controversial issues, what do you think about universities who put out, you know, statements about the hot topics of the day?
I mean, as a dean, I have been in several situations where, you know, people were pressing me and pressing the university to come out and say something in support of or in defense of or condemning. There's often a very, very strong number of people who can say, you need to condemn, right? And you're very conscious as a dean or a provost or a president that no matter what you say, you're going to, you know, make somebody angry. You know that, right? And you know also that you can't be just expressing what you believe, because you're not speaking for yourself. You're speaking for the institution. And so that's inherently an impossible task and ridiculously complicated. And I think that more times than not, we get it wrong or we do more damage than we might have done by just staying silent. So I kind of believe that the default should be silence. We should not expect administrators, right, to take positions on social issues because that's not their job. Their job is to create an environment in which those issues can be explored, discussed, learned about, researched. But, right, not every issue can be – we can't be silent about every issue. And the example that everybody keeps coming back to argue against that with is suppose you were an administrator in 1932, 1933 Germany and the Nazis were taking over. I mean, you would not want to look back and say, I said no, don't say anything. And the same thing I think about George Floyd. I mean, I think that was such a crystallizing moment in the struggles we've had with racism, you know, in our society that for people to say nothing would have been inappropriate in a certain way. And yet, when we did come out with a statement, we got savaged from both sides, right? Some people say that statement's much too weak, and then some people said that's much too strong. So, you know, one tries to make it split down the middle to some extent. But I really feel like the amount of hours that administrators have taken over trying to get a message that they really think represents the institution appropriately, what its values are, and that addresses its constituencies in a way that they'll be able to hear as opposed to find offensive or objectionable, you would be stunned at. I'll just say that. And I don't really think that you want me, right, and the other administrators on campus spending a lot of our time and our emotional energy worrying about those kind of messages ad nauseum. I think you'd rather me spend my time worrying about, like, what kind of a great program can we put together, right, that brings together statistics in English, you know, for something like that. So neither extreme works. You can't weigh in on everything, and you can't weigh in on nothing. But I would much rather see the default be that nobody expects us to weigh in. Much, much cleaner that way.
So you were mentioning social media. How do you think that contributes to the whole situation on campus and in the world?
Let me go out on a limb here and say I deeply hate social media. I mean, I think so. We have had so many incidents where somebody had some reaction to something that got posted on social media. It blew up or ricocheted around and people, you know, got very upset about it before I even knew about it. You know, so it's the cycle of the social media explosion. It's not a week. It's not even a day. It's just an hour. And so, you know, you can't find the people that need to address it and answer it within an hour or within 2 hours every time. It's not practical. And there's been so many times where somebody has taken something and then gone with it on social media that in retrospect turns out to be not just false, but radically false or misleadingly false, right? And so you're in this trap where the speed of it and the way it amplifies and reaches so many people is so overwhelming and so much beyond our own capabilities, right? Even if I go onto social media and try to actually stop the bleeding or say something, right? You know, inevitably, the speed with which I have to do it, I'll make some mistake and say something that somebody finds ridiculously, and then that will be its own story. And so every time we've been in these situations and we consider, well, we need to respond to that. They're saying something we know to be false. Somebody else says, don't say anything. You'll just make it worse. You'll provide gas to the fire. And they're right. So as quickly as it blows up, it tends to die down. But I think in general, the social media that I've seen, it worsens the discourse in almost every way.
Social media is great at letting people speak, but it's not so great when it comes to amplifying, say, misinformation or dangerous lies or even just things out of context.
Correct. And it's also not so great at somehow creating an environment in which people feel entitled or safe to say truly horrible things. Troll people and use tones or use statements that they would never say face to face because they're just too offensive and they're too socially unacceptable. But in social media, there's no problem to say it. And I think that it brings out the worst in us in a certain way. And I think it's just for all the political issues of the day, made everybody's life more stressful, more anxious, and worse. Is that extreme enough, Abby?
Well. I think a lot of people have a complicated relationship with social media.
Oh, yes. And I know I'm extreme, but I'm old. I'm in a generation where, you know, we didn't do social media, right? You know, and I brought up three daughters, and I remember this vividly with this age where when they were, like, interacting with their friends. Sometimes they'd speak in person. Sometimes they'd call them on the phone. Sometimes they'd text them. And they would modulate what they did depending on how intense the interaction was maybe going to be. Right? We never thought that. And so, you know, so I think the social media is just another outgrowth of that. It's a way to actually modulate how you're going to say something. But the way it gets amplified is just very unfortunate.
So if social media is part of the problem, what would you say is the solution to finding a good balance on this very thorny issue?
Well, I don't think you're going to stop social media. It's going to be what it is, and people are going to use it. And hopefully over time, people will come to feel about social media that it's just sort of, it's toxic, like, you know, like Twinkies are toxic, right? It's such a nice sugar high quickly. But if you keep eating Twinkies every day as your whole diet, you're going to feel like crap, right? And I think the same thing is true of social media. I think if that's your main diet, you get addicted to it, it's just stressful, you feel anxious, you don't feel good. So I think hopefully if we provide better and more opportunities for people to interact in person and have discussions that they actually can enjoy, et cetera, and learn from, that they'll choose to do more of that and less of the social media. That's pretty optimistic and hopeful, but I'll stick with it.
Well, is there anything else you want to say before we run out of time?
I think that when I have had the experience of getting students and getting faculty into context in which they have enough time and they have enough safety to say what they actually think and to explore it, they behave well and they behave incredibly intelligently and they end up doing things and saying things that we all learn from. So I believe that I've already seen enough evidence to show that if we can create the context in which speech, right, can be free and productive, that is going to be a positive thing as opposed to a negative thing. So I'm encouraged, but I think it's going to take us an enormous amount of work to get there.
This has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I've been Riona Duncan, and my guest today has been Dean Shinas. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.